God is perfect. He always has been. He always will be. However, we are not perfect in our thoughts or actions. What can or should our day-to-day relationship as functionally imperfect people with a perfect God look like? What happens when we struggle in our mind or sin with our bodies? What's appropriate when we're happy or when we want to celebrate? In our conversation through the book of Psalms called Transparency, we will discover that God has consistently lived in transparency with us and is inviting us to live in transparency with Him.
Good morning. How's everyone doing? Illuminate's doing awesome. How about this half? Is everyone doing all right? Good. If I haven't had the opportunity to meet you yet and get to know you, I'll give you a little bit about who I am before we get started this morning. My name's Bo Ayers. I was born and raised in Chesterfield, Virginia. It's a small town outside of Richmond, just to give you some perspective. It's like Taylor's is to Greenville, Chesterfield is to Richmond. It's just a small town. My whole family still lives up there. I've got two sisters. The one right above me is Jessica, and then the oldest sibling is Valerie. I'm the baby of the family. Me and my oldest sister are most alike, not because we had the same hobbies necessarily, but we did have one hobby in common, and that was picking on and making fun of the middle child. That's how it's supposed to go. You're just supposed to make fun of the middle child. Anyway, so I've got two sisters, and then I've got three nephews, Caden, Nathan, and Declan is the youngest. And then I've got my parents, my mom and my dad, who are actually here. Mom, dad, wave, that's what we do. If you want any embarrassing stories or pictures, they probably have a table in the lobby. You can just ask them. This is your chance to get any blackmail on me. Anyway, so I grew up in Chesterfield, Virginia. About 5 years ago, I came down here to go to college. And fast-forwarding time, about a year and a half ago, God made it clear to me that I needed to stay in Greenville. And for the past year or so, it has been my absolute joy and privilege to serve as a pastoral apprentice here at City Lights. And I am in love, and I'll even say captivated, by what God does here week after week. And it's nothing special that we're doing. It's not songs that we're playing or who's teaching or what we're teaching on. It's a simple fact that here at City Lights, as I've seen, God is calling people to Himself. And when you encounter God, your life changes. So we get to see lives change week after week. We've seen Camille, who's our sister who now lives in France. She's excited to be a light over there, but she trusted Jesus here a couple weeks ago. We were able to celebrate her baptism. We watched Claire's video a couple weeks ago and just see what God's doing in her life as she's been here at Sea Lights and Resonate. I've seen in my own personal life, and I know enough of your stories to know that God's changing lives week after week, and it's something to get excited about. Again, it's something that captivates me week after week. Some of the things as pastoral apprentice that I've really enjoyed having the opportunity to do, one of them would just be learning from and watching what it looks like to be a man of God, to be a follower of Christ, but also be in a pastoring role. And I've been able to watch that from my boss, which not many people can say that, from my friend and from my mentor, Chris Armfield. And it's just been incredible. Looking back on this past year, I've learned more about what it looks like to follow Christ through watching His life and through learning with Him than I ever thought I would have when I was in college. So there's that. So I've enjoyed having the opportunity to learn from Chris specifically, and there are others. Tim Johnson's been speaking into my life a lot in the past 6 months. But then also just having the opportunity to connect with y'all. Whether that's just on a Sunday morning maybe, or Wednesday night before and after Resonate, maybe at Bricks. But I've enjoyed having the opportunity to get to know y'all and we would say do life together. So whether it's that short interaction that we've had or maybe it was something a little longer like meeting for coffee or doing dinner and y'all having the opportunity to care for me, that's been the coolest part is as pastoral apprentice, I've felt more that y'all have cared for me in so many ways in the past 6 months to a year. And just whether that was inviting me in for a meal or meeting with me to talk through things or the past month I was looking for a house or somewhere to stay and all of a sudden there's like an army of people that are trying to help me. And it was just so encouraging to see that God's people wanted to demonstrate who He is to me. And then There's other times that I've had the opportunity to be invited into your lives to care for you. And those have been incredible privileges over the past year. I've enjoyed getting to meet with you and do coffee and process difficult times or to celebrate good times. And you just wanted to tell someone and I got to be that person that you told and you were all excited to. Or maybe it's in Citigroup and that's a smaller environment. There's about 10 guys that get together on a front porch downtown in a really sketchy part of town. And we're scared together, but we learn truth together. If you want to know, ask the guys. It's bad. Anyways, so whether it's that or whether it's times like this when I have the privilege, and this will be the first time that I've ever taught on a Sunday morning here at Sea Lights. Usually it happens, I'll teach at Resonate. But it is a privilege, and it is a weighty privilege, a good weighty privilege, and something that I take very seriously to have the opportunity this morning and on Wednesday nights just to unpack the scriptures with you, to come alongside of you and learn more about who God is and who we are in response to who he is. So that's a privilege. It's something that gets me excited. It's what I feel like God's calling me to do. So I'm excited to step in to more of what he has for me. So that's kind of an overview. That's a kind of like the helicopter flying over overview of what has kind of led up to this moment. Now, I would love it if just for a second we can maybe zoom in on my teenage years. And that's how we'll get started this morning. I think we all have stories from our teenage years that we wish would never get told. Part of being a communicator is you tell all of those stories. So it's embarrassing, but it's great. So I'm 16 years old. I may have been 15, but I know I wasn't older than 16 because I would have had a car if I was much older than that. But if you had asked me, if you had come up to me when I was 15 or 16 and said, Bo, what is the one thing, like I've got an extra $5,000, what can I buy you? One of the top things on my list would have been a four-wheeler. I wanted a four-wheeler really bad. All the kids in the neighborhood had dirt bikes or four-wheelers. There's that one random kid with a golf cart. It wasn't fun at all. But everyone had four-wheelers, and they had dirt bikes, and there was tons of paths. We had power lines behind our neighborhood. It was about, I don't know, probably 2,000 acres close to that to ride four-wheelers on. So I wanted a four-wheeler more than anything. And I would talk about it a lot, and when I was a kid, I don't know why, but I would make PowerPoint presentations, and that's how I would try to ask my parents for things, and I would show them, like, and the next slide, you'll see this is how much they cost, and the next slide. So I'm sure at some point I made a PowerPoint presentation of why I need a four-wheeler, and my parents had convinced me that it's not happening. They would say things like, you can borrow someone else's, or you can go hang out with your friends and use theirs, but we're not getting you a four-wheeler. Christmas that year rolls around. And I guess my parents, I mean, I'm sure they have, they watched The Christmas Story and that whole scene where the dad's like, I think there's one more present in the corner. Well, my parents kind of did that. And they say, hey, I think there's one more present in the garage that you haven't seen yet. So I get really excited. And I run outside and like the whole family's kind of coming along, but I'm the only one that's really excited because my sisters know they're never going to ride it. It's just going to be me. But so I open up the door and the first words out of my mouth, there's a four-wheeler there. The first words out of my mouth to my parents that just bought me a four-wheeler are, it's too small, it won't go fast enough. I'm ungrateful. So again, I probably started a PowerPoint presentation thing to talk them into why I need a bigger and faster four-wheeler. Somehow they agreed to it. So we traded in, we take that four-wheeler back that was like this big, and we traded in for a pretty big four-wheeler. We get it home, and again, I am pumped to get on this thing. So we unload it, I jump on it, I put my helmet on because mom's there and that's the only time kids actually wear helmets. And I start riding it and I whip out of the driveway, I go down the street into the cul-de-sac where the path starts, and 2 minutes after I get on this four-wheeler, this is what happens. I wreck it. 2 minutes. It's all it took. And I mean, at the time it was really, really bad. I'm looking at it now, I'm like, maybe it wasn't that bad. I could still ride it. But here's reality. If we can just bring this down really simple, I was trusting in this four-wheeler to bring me joy. I was trusting it to make me happy as a 15 or 16-year-old kid. And after 2 minutes, it was gone. Not gone literally, because obviously it's still there, but I knew my parents were going to be so mad. I drove that thing home that day like 2 miles an hour because I was terrified of what they were going to say. I knew that I was not going to be riding that thing for a very long time. So something that I had trusted in was now gone. And it got me thinking, even as I thought through the story this morning, it got me thinking about what we trust in every day. And it maybe it's simple things that we trust in every day. For example, today I'm going to go to lunch, and I'm going to trust that someone's not going to spit in my food. It'd be great if they don't. When we get in our cars, we trust that the people that are driving within 2 feet of us on the road aren't texting. We trust that they're going to be a safe driver and they're not just going to make one small turn to hit us head on. Or if I could push a little deeper, we trust in maybe that we'll go to bed tonight as healthy as we woke up this morning. So it got me thinking, because I've seen that I can trust in things pretty quickly that leave, what am I trusting in? Or what about you? What are you currently trusting in? Are you trusting in the solar system? Because it's there. What are you currently, this morning, right now, where you're at, trusting in? If you had asked me this question a year and a half ago, and if I was to be honest, although I wasn't a follower of Christ at the time, so I probably wouldn't have been honest, but if somehow you were able to see and I trusted you enough to expose the truth, I would have told you that I am trusting in my ability to put on a front and have this together lifestyle because I want you to think that I'm a Christian. I was trusting in my ability to fool people. Or maybe for you, you're trusting, if you're a high schooler, you're trusting your smarts or your ability to maintain friendships at school this year and be the most popular kid. Or if you're in college, similar. You're trusting in your smarts or maybe the smarts of the person next to you in class. Like you're trusting in your ability to get through class and to graduate, be the life of the party. Or maybe you're trusting in your position at work. You're finding confidence in your position at work or how much money you have or what title you wear. Or maybe you're trusting that your spouse won't find that thing out. Or that your spouse will notice something about you. What are you currently trusting in this morning? Where you're at? What are you currently trusting in? And here's why I bring this up. Because whether we realize it or not today, the Bible would show us, and it reveals truth, that the object of your trust, the object of our trust, will determine the trajectory of your life. The object of your trust will determine the trajectory of your life. This morning, if you've got your Bibles, we're going to be in Psalm 27. And we're going to see from the life of David what it looks like to trust in God, something that won't change in the midst of changing circumstances. In the midst of when things do change, when the things that we've been holding on to fall away, when those things change, what does it look like to trust in God? So if you've got your Bible, Psalm 27, if you don't have your Bible or an iPhone, my dad just got an iPhone and he was really bummed out because he said he forgot to bring his Bible. And I was like, Dad, it's on your phone. He's like, yes, I got a phone. So anyways, so it's all, you can use your iPhone or it'll be on the screens if you don't have a Bible with you. So we're going to start reading in verse 1 of Psalm 27. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When evildoers assail me to eat up my flesh and adversaries and foes, it is they who stumble and fall. Though an army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war arise against me, yet I will be confident. So let's just stop right here for a second because there's a lot going on in just three verses. David's referenced God and who God is in his life. He's talked about people eating his flesh, which is kind of weird. He's talked about armies rising against him, and then he says he's going to be confident in the midst of all of this. So let's just kind of see maybe a backstory of what's going on. And something that's so cool about the life of David, and David writes most of the Psalms, something that's really unique to David is a lot of times when we read his Psalms, we can find in other places in the Old Testament kind of the backstory of what led up to him writing that psalm or what he was going through while he was writing it. So the backstory for Psalm 27, and you don't have to turn there, it'll be on the screens, is 2 Samuel 21, 15 to 17. And I'll just read that for you. There was war again between the Philistines and Israel. And David went down together with his servants. So David went down to fight in the battle, and they fought against the Philistines. And David grew weary or tired. And Ishbi-Benob, one of the descendants of the giants, whose spear weighed 300 shekels of bronze and who was armed with a new sword, thought to kill David. So he saw David as weary and tired. I kind of, in my mind, picture David maybe already had some wounds from this battle and he's laying down maybe against a rock. And this giant sees him and he says, I'm going to kill that guy. I've got this new sword. I want to use it. I'm going to kill that guy. Because David was the guy to kill in this battle. So he thought to kill David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, came to his aid and attacked the Philistine and killed him. Then David's men swore to him, "You shall no longer go out with us to battle." So we'll pause right there. I know you type A personalities like, finish the verse. Please finish the verse. Don't move on. Okay, just real quick, just to recap what's happening. David and his men go to fight this battle. David grows tired. A guy wants to kill David. One of his men has to defend David because he's weary. And now they're saying, "David, hey, you've done great. You know, Goliath, that was your giant. This one wasn't yours. We really appreciated all you've done so far, but this just wasn't your day." And then they say, "Lest you quench the lamp of Israel. You're not going to fight anymore because we don't want the light or the lamp of Israel to go out." So David just heard himself referred to as the light of Israel, but he knows, "I'm not the light of Israel. That's not me." They're seeing who I'm worshiping, and they're thinking that that's me. In fact, Matthew Henry said it like this, "And he was indeed a burning and shining light." So he was a light, but he owns that he shone as the moon does, with a borrowed light. The light that God darted upon him reflected upon them. So in the same way that the moon is not a source of light, it just reflects the sun's light. David's saying, "Hey, that's what's happening." So these guys are saying all this stuff, and they're saying, "You're the light of Israel. We need you." And in some senses, our confidence is in that you're here. And David's saying, "Hey, don't have your confidence in me. I'm not the light. You're just seeing God through me." What you worship in private will be reflected in public. The Israelites were watching the life of David, and they were captivated, and they loved the light that they were seeing, but they were confusing God's light for just being David. And so they were falling in love with David. They thought, "I need David." And David was saying, "No, that's God." N.T. Wright, on a similar note, "So what you worship in private will be reflected in public." N.T. Wright said, "You become like what you worship. You reflect what you worship not only to the object itself, but also to the world around." So David's confidence wasn't in himself. It was in a God who doesn't change. And we're going to keep seeing that his confidence was in a God that doesn't change. Unlike me with the four-wheeler or with my ability to fool people, those things can change. God doesn't change. So let's actually go back to verse 1, and we'll walk through Psalm 27. So with this context in mind, knowing that David is kind of reflecting on a battle, he starts off, so he's just called the light of Israel. David responds by saying, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?" David just referred to God in three different ways. What are they? It's going to have to be like someone like here. What are the three different ways that David referred to God? Light, salvation, and stronghold. Yeah, so let's walk through those. So the first one, David refers to God as his light. And we've already kind of talked about this one, so we'll just kind of breeze over it real quick. These men are identifying David as his light. He says, "No, that's not me. That's God. God is the guiding force of my life. He's my light. He guides my steps. And in times of darkness, he brings to surface and he brings everything out into light." And then he refers to God as his salvation, or another word for that is just deliverance. He's saying, "God delivers me from those times." From the times, and we can use for our context, of times of changing circumstances, times of grief, times of hardship. God is my salvation. And then lastly, he refers to God as his stronghold or his strength, which in context is not ironic, but it's a cool perspective that in a moment when David is laying on the ground, potentially about to die, he says, "God is my strength." If we fast forward to Paul in the New Testament, in 2 Corinthians 12, 9 through 10, Paul is talking about this thorn in the flesh and like the verdict's still out on what the thorn actually was. But there's something in Paul that he didn't like. And he's talking to God about it. In 2 Corinthians 12, 9 and 10, Paul says, "But he, being God, said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you. For my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weakness, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, calamities, maybe changing circumstances," fill in the blank. "I'm content with those things, for when I am weak, then I am strong." So in the midst of battle, near defeat, David has confidence in God. He chooses to set his attention on God, not on what's going on. It's if we could kind of diagram that first verse, it would almost be like David was saying, "The Lord is my light, whom shall I be afraid?" Small text. Big text. "He is my salvation." Small text. "Who's going to come against me? He's my stronghold. Who can rise against me?" It's this idea of he acknowledges that there's something going on, but he's way more focused on who God is. Someone living in transparency with God trusts God's presence in the presence of grief. Someone living in transparency with God trusts God's presence in the presence of grief. So let's make that a question. What prevents you today? What prevents you from trusting God's presence in the presence of grief? And maybe some of you are pushing back and you're saying, "Bo, you don't understand. You don't know how hard this past 3 months has been for me. Every time I try to take a step and do something right, it gets harder. Bo, you don't understand how my marriage has been going for the past 5 years. We think things are going well. We're taking steps, and then something else from the past comes up. Bo, my grief doesn't seem to end." And maybe you're thinking, "Bo, you don't understand. You just referenced marriage. You're 22. Like, well, why are you referencing marriage?" And you're right. Maybe I don't understand your specific grief that you're going through right now, but I also have experienced grief. And something that I found comforting just last night as I was studying was a quote from Jerry Bridges. He says, "God's plan and his ways of working out his plan are frequently beyond our ability to fathom and understand. We must learn to trust when we don't understand." We must learn to trust when we don't understand. David continues in verse 2. "When evildoers assail me to eat up my flesh, my adversaries and foes, it is they who stumble and fall. Though an army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war arise against me, yet I will be confident." So what's David saying here? Because again, if we go back to 2 Samuel, he's laying on the ground, potentially, but he's weary, he's tired. It looks like he's about to fall and be killed. And now he's looking at other people and he's saying, "When people come against me, it's they who fall." David realized that his victory, the victory that day for that battle, wasn't wrapped up in, "Am I going to live or am I going to die?" Because as being called the light of Israel, he knew that the true light of Israel wasn't going to go out. Victory wasn't dependent on the life of David. Victory was dependent on the presence of God, which is always there. What is your confidence this morning contingent on? David's confidence was in the fact that God is the light of Israel. And he's now sharing that with the people around him. He's saying, the victory isn't up to me. I'm not the light. You're seeing God through me. So God's going to be here whether I'm physically here right now or not. What is your confidence contingent on? Is it finances? Is it how well I do in school? Do I get that raise? What is your confidence this morning contingent on? Someone living in transparency discovers the only object of lasting confidence is God. Someone living in transparency discovers the only object of lasting confidence is God. So David's able to find confidence, but where is he really finding it from? Why can he have all this confidence in God? Well, he talks about it starting in verse 4. "One thing have I asked of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. For he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will lift me high upon a rock." Basically, all David's saying, he said, "I desire God more than anything else. Privately, in my time with God, I am asking for nothing short of his presence. I want to dwell in his temple forever. I want to get to know him better. I want to learn more about his characteristics." And that's where we're seeing this confident birth out of. He continues in verse 6, "And now my head shall be lifted up above the enemies all around me, and I will dwell in the house..." One second, I lost my spot. "And now my head shall be lifted up above the enemies all around me, and I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody to the Lord." So David's confident in the character of God because he knows the character of God. So when circumstances change, when he's weary on the battlefield, David's used to being the one that's killing Goliath and killing thousands of people and victorious in battle. And all of a sudden, he's weary on a battlefield and people are telling him that he can't go fight anymore. He's confident in the character of God because he's spent time getting to know the character of God. What prevents you? What prevents you this morning from desiring God's presence above all else? David privately desired God's presence above everything else and affected his confidence level in the character of God when times changed, when circumstances changed. So we've seen David now get referred to as the light of Israel, to which he replies, it starts his mind going. He starts thinking about the character of God and the confidence that he has in God. So we've watched that happen, and now his attention turns. He goes from focusing on the attributes, the character of God, even in the midst of changing circumstances. And we talked about how it was as if the focus was who God is, and it's just like subtext, minor detail, what's going on around me. So he switches from talking to other people in that way, and now he's talking to God. He starts off, he says, "Hear, O Lord," in verse 7, but it's his attention goes from who God is to what's going on around me, which we do too. We may start, sometimes in my life, I've started off in a trying time, very confident of who God is. And even with this house situation, I mentioned that I was looking for a house. I started off very excited. I was like, "Oh God, you're going to do crazy things. Like, I'm excited to see what you're going to do." 2 weeks later, I'm sitting in staff meeting, like completely downcast. And I'm like, I don't know what God's going to do. This is getting so hard. Like, does he know that I need a house in 3 days? Like, does he get this? Has he forgotten about me? So that's kind of what we see David doing now. His attention starts turning a little bit to what's going on around me. He says, "Hear, O Lord, when I cry aloud. Be gracious to me and answer me. You have said, 'Seek my face.' My heart says to you, 'Your face, Lord, do I seek. Hide not your face from me. Turn not your servant away in anger, O you who have been my help.'" God, you've helped me before. Can you help me now? "Cast me not off. Forsake me not, O God of my salvation, for my father and my mother have forsaken me." Now we're seeing glimpses of truth here, but the Lord will take me in. "Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path because of my enemies. Give me not up to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, and they breathe out violence." So David's now focusing on, it's as if he's saying before, "God, you're good. God, you can do this. You're my light. You're my salvation. No one's going to come against me." And now it flips, and he's saying, "God, do you see what they're doing? God, they're coming against me now. They're trying to hurt me. God, they're surrounding me. God, don't forsake me. God, I know your characteristics, but right now the situation that's happening seems a lot bigger than you do." Whereas before, it was, "You seem so much bigger because you are so much bigger than this situation." So he continues, and he keeps talking, but he starts off verse 13 by saying, "I believe." David started off very confident in who God is. And then we see some doubt slip in. We see, "God, it's this idea of, God, don't forsake me. Don't cast me off. Don't turn away. God, you've helped me before. Can you help me again?" And then he makes up his mind. He makes up his mind that, "I'm going to trust God." He says, "I believe," starting in verse 13. "I believe that I shall look upon the goodness of the Lord and the land of the living." In spite of everything that's going on, "I believe that I shall look upon the goodness of the Lord and the land of the living." And now he kind of talks introspectively. It's as if he's talking to himself all of a sudden. And he says, "Wait for the Lord. Be strong. Let your heart take courage. Be confident. Trust in God. Wait for the Lord." David had a choice to make. For us today, for us in life, trusting God is a choice. Because you can trust in other things. You can trust that your money is going to last. You can trust that you'll graduate high school, you'll graduate college, you'll get a good job. You can trust in your looks. You can trust in your ability to please other people. Those are all options to trust in. But in the same way in my life, I found that my ability to fool other people and my four-wheeler, as silly as that seems, as a 15, 16-year-old, that's a big deal. But I found those things don't last. I found that no matter how much I thought this thing's going to hold me up, this thing's going to last, it didn't last. I trust in things that wouldn't last. David trusted in a God that did last. Even in the midst of his perspective changing and struggling through, like, can I trust God? God, are you still here? Don't forsake me. Please don't turn your face from me. Even in the midst of that, he found and he decided to choose that I'm going to trust God. Jerry Bridges again said this, trust is not a passive state of mind. It is a vigorous act of the soul by which we choose to lay hold on the promises of God and cling to them despite the adversity that at times seeks to overwhelm us. I'll read it one more time. Trust is not a passive state of mind. It is a vigorous act of the soul by which we choose to lay hold on the promises of God and cling to them, choosing to trust God even when adversity that at times seeks to overwhelm us. Trusting God is a choice. When I was a junior in college, a bunch of friends and I, we loved going to the pool. It was the most fun thing. Classes would get out on Friday. We would go right to the pool. We really looked for any opportunity. There was a hotel. We didn't want to go to our pool because that was boring because it was available, and why would we do that? So we would drive to like an apartment or a hotel. We would go get in the pool, and we'd have fun there. And I remember one day we went, and as we were kind of wrapping up, I just remember we were sitting on the side of the pool. I watched, and a father and his son caught my attention because they were just having a lot of fun. He was throwing his son up in the air. Son was wearing a life jacket still, so he must have been 4 or 5 years old. But the little boy looks at his dad, and he says, "Dad, I want to learn to swim." His dad says, "Okay." So he takes his life jacket off, and he does that scene, maybe you've seen it, where the dad or the mom will put the little boy or little girl on the side of the pool and will take like one step away and like clap like they're a dog, and the little boy like pushes off the side of the pool and like grabs his dad. So he did that once, and he was really close, and the little boy just looks at dad and goes, "Further." He says, "Okay." So he puts him on there again, and then he takes 2 steps back. And the little boy pushes off, and the dad just grabs him again. It wasn't hard at all. The little boy's not actually swimming at all. So he did it again because the little boy said, "I want to go further." So he puts the boy on the side of the pool. He takes like 2.5 or maybe 3 steps back. Little boy pushes off, and then he has to like stroke like one time, and then he's in his dad's arms again. And then he said, "I want to go further. Dad, I want to swim." And so the dad said, "Okay." So he puts him on the side of the pool, and as he's walking back, he's kind of putting like pool noodles. I don't remember exactly what it was, but let's just say a pool noodle and then a big float and then another float. And then he's kind of standing about this far away. He says, "All right, buddy, swim." So the little boy pushes off and he panics. He starts flailing his arms and he grabs hold of this pool noodle, and the pool noodle just sinks immediately. And then he grabs hold of like this big float, and the big float just rolls over, and the little boy's still underwater, and he screams out, "Daddy!" And by the time, if I remember correct, by the time that boy finished the word "daddy," his dad had already come in and grabbed hold of his son. In this story, the dad is God. We're the little boy. And maybe this morning, we're holding on to things that are just sinking and flipping over. What are you currently trusting in? We could call the floats finances. We could call the floats jobs or school or friends, relationships. What are you currently, right now, trusting in? Will it last? Will what you're trusting in hold you up? Does it have the ability to save you? Does it have the ability to sustain you? I thought a four-wheeler could sustain my emotions. As a kid, as a college student, I thought that my ability to fool other people and put on a front of this perfect together lifestyle, I thought that was going to last. But when enough things attacked it, it was gone. What are you currently trusting in? Will it last? And then just 2 lines for us tonight or today. In changing circumstances, by grace, we can trust in an unchanging God. In changing circumstances, in times of grief, when things around us are falling away, we can, just like the little boy found that his dad grabbed him, we can trust in an unchanging God. The last line is this: someone living in transparency with God sees changing circumstances as opportunities to trust God. Someone living in transparency with God sees changing circumstances as opportunities to trust God. Well, why is God trustworthy? In the same way that in the story of the pool, the dad moved in to grab hold of his son that was flailing and looking for something to hold on to, God did the same thing for us a little over 2,000 years ago. Jesus watched as we, his father's children, were flailing around looking for things to hold on to, and he knew that fellowship with the Father had been broken because of sin, sin that we chose to do. And he was willing to come down and die for us so that we could be in restored fellowship with him. We were looking for other things. And some of us here this morning have already found that God was there and he is something to hold on to and trust. And he doesn't move, even in the midst of changing circumstances. So what about you? What are you trusting in? Let's just pray together. God, thank you that you are trustworthy, that you are a good God, that you do love us, that you were willing to send your son to die for us so that we could see that you are a trustworthy and good God. God, we love you because you first demonstrated what love looks like to us. So we thank you for that. God, you are a good God. You are a loving God. You are a patient God. You're a consistent God. You're worthy of every ounce of trust that we have, because we know in trusting you, we're not trusting in a shakable source. We're shaking in a God. We're trusting in a God that can't be shaken. So we love you, God. Amen.
Thanks for listening to the podcast today. If the Lord used this message to speak to you, would you consider leaving us feedback on our iTunes or Facebook page? We would love to hear about what God is doing in your life. If you would like to know more about City Lights and how you can get involved, please visit our website at www.citylights.cc for more information. Have a great day.